Court will proceed to the second case of the day, DeGuilly v. Camilli. Mr. Reeves?
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Mr. DeGuilly blew the whistle on a pattern of tax fraud, and then he was harassed and fired for it. And the District Court found that even though he otherwise pled all of the elements of a RICO claim, the Court dismissed his RICO claims on the ground that the retaliatory acts were not sufficiently related to the acts of tax fraud that he blew the whistle on. We think that conclusion is wrong and should be reversed for three reasons. One, it's contrary to the Supreme Court's test for relationship articulated in the H.J. case, which articulated a flexible and common sense approach to determining when acts are related to form a pattern. Second, the Court's opinion really, I think, misreads and ignores key factual allegations in the complaint. And third, Your Honor, I think if the District Court opinion stands, it would be contrary to the dominating purpose of Sarbanes-Oxley, which was passed specifically to combat corporate fraud, to protect whistleblowers, and to encourage whistleblowing claims. And in particular, relevant to this case, is the Congress, when it passed Sarbanes-Oxley, made retaliatory conduct predicate acts under RICO. And that's important because Sarbanes-Oxley was passed in 2002, 2 years after the Supreme Court case of Beck versus Prupas. And I'll talk about Beck more really in connection with conspiracy. But in the Beck case, there was a similar whistleblowing case where Beck blew the whistle on a variety of corporate conduct, misconduct, and then he was fired. And the only reason his claim didn't survive is because at that time, retaliation wasn't a RICO predicate act. 2 years later, Congress passed Sarbanes and made retaliation a RICO predicate act. And I would submit, Your Honor, if the District Court opinion stands, it would be an incongruous result where the only way a whistleblower would be able to bring a RICO claim would be if he alleges a pattern of retaliation. I think it would be impossible, if the District Court opinion were to stand, for a whistleblower ever to blow the whistle on corporate conduct and bring a RICO claim if he's fired for blowing the whistle on the corporate conduct. So if you apply, again, in H.J., it talked about, admittedly, it is a tough standard, and it's been a tough standard for the courts to apply. I guess I shouldn't say tough. It's been a...
Strict.
Well, I don't know that it's actually strict, Your Honor, because according to the court in H.J., it's supposed to be flexible, and it's supposed to be common sense. And, in fact, in most RICO cases, the relationship test is easily satisfied, and most RICO cases fail because of a lack of continuity or a lack of enterprise or a lack of injury, something like that, but really not usually because of a failure of the relationship test. And for the court to reach the opinion that it did, this is where I think the court really did misread the complaint. The court really had to read the complaint narrowly as two completely separate schemes perpetuated by completely different people. And that misreads the complaint, and it ignores the role of at least some of the key defendants. It is true that some of the defendants were only involved in the retaliatory acts, and some of the defendants were only involved in the tax fraud acts. But at least with respect to Wenzel in particular, Wenzel is alleged to have been involved in nearly every act of racketeering, of mail fraud and tax fraud, but he was also alleged to have been personally involved in at least two acts of retaliation. Similarly, Defendant Randleman was alleged to have been involved in both approving an amended fraudulent tax return as well as approving a retaliatory negative review. So the district court's conclusion that the conduct was carried out by completely separate defendants is wrong. It's really contrary to the complaint allegations.
Mr. Reese, the defense also suggests that even if you combine the two schemes identified by the district court, that you would still fail to allege a pattern because this was a kind of closed-end effort limited to some finite fund of international tax credits. Is that what do you have to say?
Yeah, they do say that, and I think that, again, is an overly narrow reading of the complaint allegations because Mr. DeGale's allegations go beyond simply the foreign tax credit scheme. He does certainly allege several acts involving the foreign tax credit scheme and efforts to cover up that scheme, but he also alleges conduct involving destruction of evidence, improper deduction for cost of goods sold, fraud involving a Form 5471. Those are other acts that aren't narrowly limited to the foreign tax credit scheme. And so, again, the scheme, I guess, in some ways in these cases can be in the eye of the beholder, but if you look at the complaint, Mr. DeGale certainly alleges conduct that goes beyond the foreign tax credit scheme. And the other thing that's important is he alleges, I think, fairly an ongoing scheme. And that's really becomes important with respect to the conspiracy claim because while there is much conduct that occurs in the earlier period, even after the retaliatory acts start happening, the defendants are accused of having filed yet another amended tax return related to the scheme, which we think at least gives rise to a fair conclusion that the scheme was to be able to commit a variety of tax fraud and get Mr. DeGale out of the way so he would stop complaining about it and so they could continue to conduct their activities really unabated by Mr. DeGale's interference. With respect to the conspiracy claim, you know, the district court didn't consider it because once it had dismissed the 1962C claim, it thought it didn't need to consider the D claim. And, Your Honors, I certainly acknowledge that if a C claim cannot ever succeed, that then it may be appropriate to dismiss the D claim. But as the Supreme Court, I think, really articulated the test in Salinas, the test is not whether the defendant has violated C or even whether someone else has violated Section 1962C or one of the other substantive violations, but whether that conduct, if completed, would constitute a violation. Here, I would ask the court to compare this case to the Beck case that I mentioned earlier. In Beck, Beck was the CEO of a company. He complained specifically of a pattern of fraudulent conduct. He was then, I think, accused of not having performed his job in a trumped-up evaluation, and he was fired. And the Supreme Court, at least, in that case, and I think all the other courts, at least accepted that the firing was in furtherance of the scheme. At least the question presented to the Supreme Court in Beck was whether the way they articulated it was whether conduct, termination in furtherance of a scheme could give rise to a RICO claim if that termination was not a predicate act of racketeering. But it was really accepted by all the parties. Now, maybe it wasn't challenged, I don't know for sure, but it seemed to be accepted that the retaliatory acts were in furtherance of the scheme. And the only reason that Beck's claim failed is because, again, at that time, retaliation was not a predicate act.
Mr. Reese, could you address the cases decided after Sarbanes-Oxley involving whistleblower claims? In particular, have any cases adopted your approach that you're advocating here, which would say, in essence, the retaliation and the underlying criminal conduct, whatever it might be that's alleged, are related?
Mm-hmm. On that point, I think this could be a case of first impression and important because all the cases that are cited by the defendants that are some are pre and some are post Sarbanes-Oxley cases, I read all of those, and none of those apply Beck, and I don't think they really apply the right standard. So, for example, and I'd have to pull out exactly which case is which, but I know that the cases that came closest to dealing with a situation found that the plaintiff couldn't bring a whistleblowing claim because, again, the court assumed that the retaliation was not a RICO predicate act. So it's important that in all of those cases that are cited, by the defendants at least, none of them apply Beck and none of them really apply Sarbanes-Oxley in the fact that Congress specifically made retaliation a predicate act. So we haven't found a case that's specifically on fours with this one. I mean, Beck is the closest, but since Beck and since Sarbanes-Oxley, we have not found a case where that specifically involves this particular set of conduct. I think that's what makes this case particularly important. Your Honor, if I'm happy to answer other questions or reserve the remainder of my time for...
There is one other thing I'd like to ask you about, yes. Mr. Reese, and that is... It doesn't have to do with the RICO pleading issues, but it looks like your client had a big loss in the state courts, a final judgment now.
Yes.
In that case, and if I understand your claim correctly, your client is claiming he was injured by his termination, by the filing of the lawsuit in which S.C. Johnson has now prevailed, and by defamation in connection with statements about that lawsuit. So if we were to agree with you on the RICO pleading issue, it seems like there would be a pretty obvious claim and issue preclusion set of defenses that you would see.
Yes. Issue preclusion or claim preclusion would be an affirmative defense. It would turn on facts that would, I think, look to comparisons between the two cases. I think one thing that's important is that the claim filed in Wisconsin State Court was filed only by S.C. Johnson against Mr. DeGale. And so it involved different parties.
Well, but your whole point in this case is that they were all acting on behalf of S.C. Johnson and in the course of their employment, right?
That's true, but they are involving different parties. One of the fundamental differences of RICO is that you can have a claim against individual defendants who are operating the enterprise, S.C. Johnson, which is not the defendant in the RICO claim, at least. And, you know, again, under Sarbanes, I think it's in part to also go against the individual people who are the bad actors.
Yeah, but, I mean, look, in the state court action, didn't S.C. Johnson prove that the acts that those people took were proper?
Well, what they proved is an open question, I think, Your Honor. I think that if an estoppel or some kind of preclusion claim were raised as an affirmative defense, there would be questions not only about, you know, the differences of the parties, but there would also be questions about whether that claim was fully and fairly litigated under the circumstances. And similarly, Your Honor, there would be questions about the potentially different elements where retaliation under Sarbanes outlaws taking action against someone for providing information, mm-hmm. whereas a wrongful termination case under state law outlaws taking action against someone for refusing to follow a legal command. There may be nuances there that could undermine a preclusion claim.
Mm-hmm. Is your firm involved in the state court litigation?
No, we're not, Your Honor. We were appointed for this appeal, and that's what we've handled.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reeves.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Clement?
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The fundamental difficulty with the plaintiff's allegations in this case is the failure to allege an adequate pattern under RICO. And there are two species of problems with the particular pattern alleged. One goes to relationship, one goes to continuity. I want to start with relationship, which is obviously the ground that the district court focused on. As to the problem with the relationship, there really is a very case-specific problem with the relationship, and then I think a broader issue. And as the counsel for the appellant correctly admitted, you know, if this court wants to look at the broader issues here, this could really be a case of first impression. On the other hand, this case need not be a case of first impression, because if you look at the allegations here, kind of uniquely problematic from the standpoint of alleging a relationship between the underlying alleged tax problems and the underlying alleged retaliation. And that is because there are different actors. And as you might expect with a larger company, it's not a simple matter of the people in the tax department who are alleged to engage in misconduct being able to essentially fire this individual. But instead, in a large corporation like SC Johnson, you would need to get the HR department involved. And they are really different actors, and they acted in a way that really shows the retaliation here is unrelated. And this is based on what's even alleged in the complaint itself, because the complaint itself recognizes that one of the things the Human Resources Department did was to get an outside law firm in to investigate the underlying allegations of tax fraud. Now, that is not the actions of a co-conspirator trying to ease the path of the tax fraud. That is, in a sense, if you have co-conspirators like that, who needs enemies, getting this outside law firm involved in the process.
What do we make of Mr. Wenzel's role in both the tax department and involved in the decision to terminate?
Well, Mr. Wenzel's involvement, as based on the allegations of the complaint in the retaliation, are very thin. I mean, basically, he tried perhaps to retaliate by giving an unfavorable review, but that was an unfavorable review that the Human Resources Department itself recognized was problematic and reversed. So in a sense, to the extent that Wenzel sort of had an attempted retaliation here, that was really those efforts were frustrated. There's almost a fire break in the causation here that is the Human Resources Department and the way that they reacted to this complaint. And I think that under those circumstances, without going any further and saying anything broader about the circumstances in which retaliation claims generally are related to underlying fraud claims, I think this court could focus on the specifics of the allegations here and go no further. Now, I do want to address the broader issue, because I don't think the rule that should emerge from this case or any other case is that all you need to do to make a retaliatory discharge case, a RICO case, is to allege some unrelated pattern of misconduct and then a retaliation for trying to blow the whistle on it. I think the burden on a RICO plaintiff in those circumstances is a greater burden to show that the retaliation is not some isolated injury to that particular individual, but to make allegations that the retaliation is part and parcel of the pattern of wrongdoing. And I think you can imagine a situation where it's alleged that there's, say, a pattern of wrongdoing that requires lower-level individuals to make certain certifications. And so in those circumstances, a plaintiff could allege, look, I wouldn't do those certifications. I was retaliated for not being willing to do it. And in order to make their scheme function, they needed to fire me, not so much because to get rid of me, but to send a message to the other people on the inside that if you don't do what we need you to do, there will be serious consequences. But that's not what is alleged here. I mean, the retaliation here is very much focused on the individual plaintiff. It's not a situation where the individual plaintiff is sort of a necessary cog in the wheel of the tax fraud scheme. I mean, back in 2001, he's asked to, based on the allegations, make some modifications to a document. But generally speaking, going forward, he's not the one who's signing the tax returns. He doesn't have an integral role. His role, if any, is that, you know, he thinks that the calculations are improper, and he, many years later, back in 2008, informs people internally of that and ultimately informs people externally. So I think if you want to avoid the situation this court has been sensitive to in other contexts of saying, look, we don't want to have sort of garden variety retaliatory discharge claims converted into RICO claims, I think you'd want to, you in a sense, want to ask for more, and I think that more is missing.
The argument you're making would also apply in the criminal context, correct?
I think it would, Your Honor.
And how would it apply, for example, let's assume what we've got added to the in Sarbanes-Oxley is retaliation connected with employment, added to other sorts of obstruction and witness intimidation efforts. Of the kind that are familiar from, let's say, more hardcore extortion, strong-arm tactics, racketeering efforts. How would your theory apply to somebody who is accused of of having done the witness intimidation. They say, well, that has no relationship to the underlying arson, extortion, fraud scheme that this was part of.
Yeah, Your Honor, I think there's a big difference between witness tampering and retaliation, and I think the district court recognized that, which is witness tampering is there's a much closer nexus because you're basically trying to keep somebody from testifying adversely.
But under Sarbanes-Oxley, isn't that what Congress was trying to tell us to pay attention to?
Well, I think it depends on the circumstances, Your Honor, because I think, as the district court said, with kind of a common sense that I think certainly resonates with me, if you're talking about a single individual, if you actually discharge them from the company and put them on sort of the outside of the tent, you're actually probably increasing the chances of them blowing the whistle on what's going on.
You're also sending signals to those who remain in the company.
And that's where I think the key allegations that you would have to have that are missing here.
Does he have to allege that?
Oh, I would think so. No, I would. I mean, obviously, this court will make that.
To me, the connection between witness tampering, retaliation, and the underlying conduct is pretty self-evident, in at least in theory.
Well, again, I think it depends. Maybe in theory, I think it depends on the circumstances. And I do think sort of witness tampering, I think, is always going to be more tightly moored to the cover-up. I think a retaliatory discharge, because if you look at that individual in isolation, by putting him outside of the tent, you actually increase the chances.
Sure, but we're going to put him outside, we're going to sue him, we're going to crush him. That sends a pretty strong message, and it might work. And maybe it did. Or maybe Miguel is just totally off base, and I'm aware of the state court decision.
But, right.
But we've got to take this on the pleadings.
I understand you have to take this in the pleadings, but I would think on the pleadings you would want somebody to have to make those allegations to say, look, my retaliatory discharge is not an isolated event. It is part and parcel. And I think, as I said, if you had a different kind of underlying, sort of RICO, other RICO predicates, where it was important to have the employees participate actively in the underlying misconduct, I think it would be much easier to make those kind of allegations that under these circumstances, the retaliation is really part and parcel of the scheme. I think you could also have circumstances where the retaliation is not isolated, and there is, in fact, a pattern of retaliation that is then tied into the scheme. And that would, again, be, I think, an easier pattern and would suggest a pattern. And
Mr. Quinn, how would you frame that heightened pleading standard if we were to address it?
Well, I think I would say that the heightened pleading standard is to show that the retaliation is not an isolated event but part of a pattern that is essentially reinforces the underlying RICO violation. And, I think you go back to H.J., and you go back to both the test of relationship and continuity. Well, the court's not asking you to look at those factors in isolation. It's, not every relationship counts. It's relationship that creates a pattern. And it seems to me that if you have an isolated retaliation, that's, it might be a straight line, but it's not a pattern. There's no breadth to what's going on. There's no suggestion it's going to be repeated. And I think it's helpful to think about this, to think about a hypothetical case where the way that the plaintiff gets to two RICO predicates is just one underlying fraud and one underlying act of retaliation. Now, in that circumstance, I think you'd want to be very careful about saying that's enough to allege a pattern, because that seems like something where there is an obvious endpoint, to use this court's phrase from Gamboa. I think a similar idea was in the Midwest Grinding case. It's like, well, if this is all designed for the retaliation, that's likely to happen once and then it's over. Now, as you have a broader pattern and you have a retaliation as part of that, I think you would want to insist that there be additional allegations that say, look, this isn't a single retaliation. These are circumstances where the retaliation is either, I think the easy case is when there's repeated retaliation. I don't think it's limited to that, but I think you'd really want to ask for more, because otherwise I think you're in a situation where every retaliation is going to be a RICO case, because, I want to talk before I sit down about the sort of continuity as to the broader tax fraud, because I actually think it's missing here. But most people that blow the whistle on something they think is at least mail fraud or wire fraud. And so I think there is a real danger here. I mean, this, you hear a lot of slippery slope arguments, but I think this is a real one under these circumstances.
But have you cited some cases decided after Sarbanes-Oxley. Did any of those actually address the statutory amendment that added retaliation as a, to the definition of racketeering activity?
I don't think they addressed it in the kind of length that you might be looking for, Your Honor. I think that
they even knew it was there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd have to go back and read them. I think there's at least a couple that may avert to it. But I think their reasoning was much more relying on pre-Sarbanes-Oxley cases that looked at other sort of allegations of cover-up, and courts have been suspicious, as I say, pre and post, about efforts to say that somebody who's alleged to have covered up the scheme is therefore part and parcel of it without sort of something more. I do want to say a word or two about continuity. I think there's problems, again, that are specific to the case and are more general. The ones that are specific to the case is that if you look at what is really alleged here to be the RICO scheme, and I would specifically direct your attentions to paragraph 154D, 155, 161, and 163, because what those paragraphs all do is they describe the scheme as really being about the foreign tax credits. And there's a few stray comments in the complaint at various points about the, you know, mysterious Form 5471 and some other instances in which there was a disagreement between the plaintiff and his supervisors. But when it comes to really alleging the scheme, it's all about the foreign tax credits. And if that is the rest of the scheme, then with respect, I think the district court was wrong to find continuity there. I mean, this is really, as alleged, it's a one-time sort of, you know, almost found money where, as alleged, the company comes into possession of foreign tax credits that they're maybe not supposed to have. And it's in the nature of these foreign tax credits that there's something of a long gestation period. I mean, you know, you can use them across different tax years, but I don't think that's the kind of continuity that really suggests that this is a pattern, that this is likely to recur. I mean, you know, in a sense, if you really take the allegations seriously and focus on the foreign tax credits, unless this company once again comes into sort of a windfall of foreign tax credits based on an IRS mistake, this pattern is unlikely to repeat itself, and I don't think that's enough under this court's cases. I also think, though, in an odd way, and I alluded to this earlier, including the retaliation count in the RICO pattern actually almost hurts from a continuity standpoint, because to the extent that's part of the pattern, then the question is that pattern likely to recur? And I think the answer, based on the allegations here, is no. You know, the pattern of retaliating against somebody on the inside is unlikely to recur. Again, and I do think this complaint is different from some of the other ones you might see in other post-Sarbanes-Oxley cases. This is, if you read this complaint, it's really all about the plaintiff. It's not about sort of a recurring scheme where the plaintiff, like others, was forced to play a particular role, and so by him blowing the whistle, he was really kind of standing in the shoes of others, and the retaliation against him might send a message to others. All of that's missing here, and I think that's really important, because if you have a case where the focus is on just this one plaintiff who suffered just this one retaliatory discharge, then the case looks a lot more like Gamboa, where, you know, it's a single scheme with an obvious endpoint.
Isn't it kind of unusual, though, to have more than one whistleblower against whom you can retaliate? I'm thinking of, for example, Sarbanes-Oxley, we know, was enacted in the wake of the Enron debacle, where there were was at least one person who became fairly famous for having blown the whistle. But would such a person need to have partners in order to be able to pursue a RICO claim?
No, but I think there would still, what you'd want is some allegation that there were others similarly situated at the company, so that, you know, retaliating against that individual would send a signal to others inside the company. And I think in that way you might tie it more closely to the underlying scheme. I mean, you know, I think if you had a whistleblower, for example, who was a necessary party to certify the truth of some financial document, so by withdrawing that person, you're still going to need somebody new to come in and sign those documents. I think that would be a case that would much more naturally lend itself to saying, look, this retaliation was part and parcel of the overall pattern. But I think that's missing here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Clement. Mr. Rees?
This does not present a slippery slope problem because RICO, as this court knows, already has many checks on RICO claims. As I said before, it's hard to bring a RICO claim, and if someone blows the whistle on some misconduct, that's not going to give rise to a RICO claim unless there is an overall pattern. I think both of us are saying the same thing with respect to continuity and relationship. You do have to apply them both, but what's interesting about that is where you get continuity is precisely where you have multiple schemes involving multiple victims. And so here you do have the government as another victim that's injured. You do have, we don't deny that there is sort of a scheme related to tax fraud as well as acts of retaliation, but Mr. DeGale does allege that that's part of an overall scheme to get him out of the picture so that they could continue their misconduct. Congress certainly knew the risk and knew the issue when it passed the statute, but it certainly did not, I think there's nothing that indicates that Congress expected that the only kind of RICO claim that could be based on retaliation would be cases that involve multiple acts of retaliation. Those might exist, but that doesn't certainly have to exist. And just to go back to Judge Hamilton's question, I think in our reply brief, page 3, footnote 1, we do address the cases that are the pre- and post-Sarbanes cases and note that none of those cases address Sarbanes. And there was one of the post cases that was, a district court opinion that did dismiss it, but again, I think really misread it because it applied really the pre-Beck standard, or it found really that the claim failed because the injury couldn't sustain a claim, couldn't support standing, but really ignoring Beck altogether, or ignoring really the change of Sarbanes. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Reed, and thank you, Mr. Klein. The case is taken under advisement.